Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the technology podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski. This week's big news, of course, comes from the attention-grabbing headlines in the world of mobile telephony.
The iPhone 3G has been great. And that's why I'm really excited to tell you about an entirely new version, the iPhone 3GS. Now, the S simply stands for speed, because this is the most powerful, fastest iPhone we've ever made.
That was the Apple press conference, giving the next generation iPhone some talk. This weekend, Palm also distributed the goods in the form of their much-anticipated Pre. Have smartphones finally graduated from the geek community to the mainstream? Well, joining me to debate this and more are Charles Arthur, esteemed editor of technology here at The Guardian, and Dan Sung, editor of Tech Digest at Shiny Media. Welcome to you both. So, Charles, you've been watching the glacial progress of smartphones for a while now.
About 15 years.
Is it actually 15 years?
It's something like that. I mean, I certainly recall the big hype that there was with BT Cellnet, as it was with the launch of WAP, where they had a load of people in the room saying, and look at this WAP, look at how quickly you can download stuff. And this is, you know, it was because broadband had barely been invented, it felt like. And so, you know, the fact that it was glacial, it was sort of, you know, which glacier runs faster.
Dan, do you bow down to the smartphone god? Do you worship at the altar?
Well, I've been sort of looking through the window for a while into the church. My own personal phone is not a smartphone, but I'm writing about them all the time. And of course, you get to try them out in our trade, which is rather good. And I've got an N97 on me at the moment, so I will be buying one as soon as the round of phones comes out this summer and I decide exactly which is the one for me.
I like that. So you're a more considered approach as opposed to diving in.
I think I'm just scared.
It's a bit of an outlay, I have to say. Well, we'll be discussing that and more later on in the program. We'll also be joined through the wonders of modern technology by Bobby Johnson, who'll be dishing the dirt on the latest tech specs that have come out of the Apple announcement. And we'll be peeking at the diary of Steve Jobs. Well, the fake Steve Jobs, that is. Our correspondent Kevin Anderson tracked Daniel Lyons down at the recent Thinking Digital conference in Newcastle and asked him what was so funny about impersonating one of the most revered tech geeks in the world. It's June, and yep, I've been consulting my calendar. It's time for Apple's annual headline-grabbing technology reveal. This year, it's another iPhone with whizzier bells and whistles. I'll leave the details to Bobby, who's got a few things on his mind about the latest smartphone kit.
On Saturday morning, shoppers in America were treated to a familiar sight, a queue of excitable young men and women who couldn't wait to get their hands on the latest gadget. But they weren't queuing for the new iPhone, or a Google phone, or even a BlackBerry. Instead, they were drawn by the Palm Pre, the new touchscreen handset from a company that many had written off as an also-ran in the mobile phone industry.
Isn't it beautiful when life simply flows together? Introducing the Palm Pre.
As an attempt to recover Palm's lost momentum, the Pre seems about as good as it could be. It's a clever, well-made device that feels comfortable and intuitive. It's got a keyboard, a slightly curved body, but its debt to the iPhone is clear as soon as you start using it. However, the Pre also seems to have an identity of its own. It's not just a limp, rushed iPhone copy like, say, the BlackBerry Bold, or an attempt to shoehorn in touch-sensitive controls like we see on many Windows mobile devices. As a result, the excitement among shoppers this week has been palpable, if not overwhelming. The queues didn't go round the block, but there was certainly an excitement among the men and women who were queuing up there to get their hands on a Pre. The day after launch, however, the situation was very different. By 5 o'clock on Sunday, the Palm Pre display at my local electronics shop was stripped clean of products, bereft of even a single Pre for punters to look at. It wasn't that the Pre hadn't been here. I could buy any number of accessories, but we were all out of luck if we wanted to see the handset, let alone pay for one of our own. The story was the same across the whole of the US, with shops only given a handful of handsets to sell on launch day. A dozen here, 20 there, maybe 50 if you were lucky. And while companies manufacture sellouts sometimes to crank up customer excitement, it seems almost suicidal to have such low levels of stock given the pre-release hype. Of course, one reason for the reasonably muted response was that everybody was waiting for the new iPhone 3GS, which was duly announced by Apple on Monday.
The iPhone 3GS, it is the fastest, most powerful iPhone yet. An incredible 3-megapixel autofocus camera, voice control, digital compass. So when does the iPhone 3GS become available? Very soon, just a week and a half, June 19th.
The 3GS is no blockbuster, but Apple is slowly incorporating many of the things into the iPhone that people said were missing from its predecessors. It's going to have copy and paste, for example, as well as supporting multimedia messaging, having a video-capable camera, and allowing laptop tethering. But the big surprise was really how soon Apple will have it in the shops. The 3GS should be available on the 19th of June for a variety of prices, most of them rather high, and still exclusive to O2 in Britain. So who wins? Well, Palm's showing was creditable, and the middle-of-the-road announcement of the iPhone 3GS makes it more likely that Palm will get some traction with the pre. But both companies are in this for the long haul. This isn't an easy fight that's going to be over soon. Earlier this year, Palm chairman John Rubinstein told me that the pre was just the first step in a recovery plan that could take 10 years to unfold.
You set the vision of what you're going to go do and where you're going, and everybody jumps on board. Pre is the first product, right? But there's other products in the pipeline. And you know, the key is not to build just one great product. The key is to build a team that can make great products time and time again, right? And then put a roadmap in place that brings out a steady stream of great products.
John Rubinstein there has an admirably long-term view in an industry so often focused on the next big thing, and some of that may have rubbed off from his previous job as the boss of Apple's hardware division. But regardless of Palm's success over the past few days, what it really needs to do is beat Apple's hype machine, and to do that, it's going to need an international bestseller. That seems as far away as ever. 6 months after the device was first announced, we still haven't heard anything official about the launch of the handset outside North America. And meanwhile, the iPhone 3GS will be in shops around the world as early as next week. In the end, it could be time that ends up being Palm's biggest enemy. After all, the promise of jam tomorrow is a really tough sell when somebody else is selling jam today.
That was Bobby Johnson with his views on the latest smartphone benchmark and how companies like Palm are starting to push the envelope with the release of their new Pre. Now, Dan, what are the Pre's chances, do you think, in this market?
That's a good question, really. I mean, I think the Pre itself is very much the preserve of the true tech geek. It's going to be a lot of people won't have heard of it when it comes out. And it's very hard to put that in the same field as something like the iPhone, which is just an incredibly desirable product generally, apart from its features. So does it stand a chance? Yeah, you know, I think it'll work. I think it'll sell out just like it has in America today. But, you know, will it be as popular as the iPhone? Probably not.
There are other smartphones that are out there that are sort of bubbling under the surface. I'm thinking specifically about things like Google's Android. You know, people have been talking about that for a while. I know that there are a few out in the market. But Charles, who would you say are the other real competitors in this market? Who would you say are going to be the winners on the podium of smartphone?
Well, you should never count out Microsoft. I mean, they're doing a lot of work with Windows Mobile, and they do actually sell a lot of Windows Mobile licenses every year. The thing is that it's been a clunky mobile system compared to, you know, what the iPhone is. The iPhone is very slick, very, very tightly integrated to the hardware. Whereas Windows Mobile is, you know, it's like the PC model where, you know, any handset maker can have it. But a lot of them then choose, having got Windows Mobile on the top, to skin it with their own software, which means you almost have sort of software fighting against other software, and it gets to be a bit of a mess. I think Microsoft is really trying to get its head around what it needs to do properly here, and it will be interesting to see later this year how it gets on with that. And there's also Symbian, which wants to really make an impact here as well, because it, you know, Apple and Google with the Android operating system are making a lot of the running here.
Well, I think there's something that we aren't considering as well. We're focusing very much on the hardware or even the software, but we're not talking about the carriers. And I think that's an interesting question here. Ultimately, as you were saying before, Charles, these smartphones or smart-ish phones have been on the market for a long time. But why is it now that the mainstream is starting to desire them, that they are available? Is it because the carriers have jumped on the bandwagon? Who holds the power here?
It's more that the carriers, certainly in the UK, spent a lot of money for 3G licenses. They then had to build a lot of 3G systems, you know, 3G connectivity, so that they could at some possible future date make their money back. And then they had the problem that they were charging too much for the data because they wanted to get their money back quickly and no one would take it. So what's changed now is that they've decided to try to make the money back by lowering their data prices and getting a lot of people piling in. So the whole smartphone idea where you actually have data on the move becomes a viable one.
And I'm wondering, Dan, what it is about these smartphones that makes them right now. You know, what? Why do we want all of these things? Do we need all of these things?
Obviously, as a tech journalist, I kind of try and step back every now and then and ask myself this kind of question because we get very het up about what we want and what's desirable. But, you know, I'm sitting on the bus the other day using my N97 thinking this is really great. I can do all sorts of things with this. But, you know, does the average person really want, or more to the point, as you say, need it? And I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. It's so hard to try and step back from it. I suspect that people don't. But I think things like YouTube and stuff like that really, and the iPlayer particularly, bringing video to people across the internet in a really big way. I think maybe it's not so much need, but it becomes very, very desirable. And I think once the BBC are into that, it starts to filter down in quite a big way.
Charles, what do you think?
Well, one of the things that of course, we didn't mention is RIM with its BlackBerry offering, which actually was the thing that really made smartphones or a particular set of the smartphone feature set, i.e. email on the move. The BlackBerry was the real breakthrough. It's overlooked a bit, but RIM is really fighting back. It really wants to get the mind share away from Apple. So, you know, you have a three-way, four-way, five-way sort of fight here where the offering's going to improve. And I think the network operators are actually just getting steamrolled because they have to be able to offer these things and they have to be able to push down the price of the data. Or else people will just say, well, you know, I can get it cheaper somewhere else.
Well, the exclusivity question is something that we can touch on in another conversation because that certainly seems to be the business model that a lot of the carriers are running with. Head to guardian.co.uk/technology for the details of the iPhone 3GS and the best analysis of smartphones on the web.
Well, first I want to clarify, I'm not fake Steve Jobs.
Well, that was Bill Gates firmly denying that he is not the fake Steve Jobs. But the cult of Steve Jobs is alive and well. At this week's press launch in Cupertino, the question was less what the technology would do for us and more whether Jobs, the erstwhile head honcho, would be there, descended amongst his flock, gracing his worshippers with his presence, et cetera, et cetera. I think Roy Kethlin Jones said that he would only go to the press launch if he saw him descending from a golden chariot. Or was that you, Charles?
No.
Descending from a golden chariot.
That's what would have got it onto the 10 o'clock news.
Well, no other.
Like Bruno and Eminem, I think.
But no other technology geek but Steve Jobs has achieved such rock star status, and that is what Daniel Lyons, a.k.a. the fake Steve Jobs, set out to satirize with a cult of his own. The Forbes and Newsweek editor-at-large by day, blinding satirist by night, met with The Guardian's Kevin Anderson recently and spilled the beans on what inspired him to ascend the Apple throne and what eventually led him to stop. Kevin started by asking him why he started.
I really started it as a joke, right? I mean, it was really, I wasn't ever thinking it was going to take off or become a big thing. And the real, ironically, the real impetus for me was not the content, but the technology. Like, I had written this big article in Forbes that was sort of taken to be, we hate blogs. And it wasn't really. I was a big fan of blogs, but I was writing about bloggers who would be, you know, putting out fake information to short stocks, whatever. It became a very controversial article about blogs. And I realized, I had this epiphany, which is that, you know, I'm missing something here. Like, I'm just not getting it. And then I thought, you know, I am here writing about blogs, and yet I've never written a blog. So I should go. And, by the way, you know, print journalism is going away, and, like, I'm in my 40s, and I'm going to have to learn these skills if I'm going to keep my job or a job. So I was really starting blogs to learn how the blog software worked. And they, you know, I'd do them and throw them away, And then I did, or just abandon them. I did this one on Steve Jobs only as a joke because I remembered in Private Eye here in the UK that secret diary of that they always have that feature. And I tried a few different tech people. I think I did Sergey Brin, but it was lame. And somehow I got into Steve Jobs, and I wrote a few things. And after 6 weeks, I said, okay, I'm done with that. And I erased it all and shut it down. I thought, okay, I'll do something. And it turns out, though, people were reading it. They put it back up and said, what happened to this blog? And I thought, oh, my God, I've found an audience without knowing it. This, who was, what happened to Fake Steve? And I wrote and said, look, I'm Fake Steve. Because someone else was writing as Fake Steve. And I said, no, that's a fake Steve. I'm the real Fake Steve. And it pissed me off that someone else was going to grab my idea and go do something with it. And it wasn't, his wasn't that good.
Do you find it kind of surreal that you were trying to prove that you were the real fake?
That starts to get fun and interesting, right? A lot more fun than my job at Forbes, which was, you know, covering enterprise tech at IBM. Like, so this was like, you know, hilarious. And I'm playing cat and mouse with these guys. And what they didn't get was, or maybe they got it, but they still liked it. I was taking the piss out of Steve Jobs, out of Apple. But clearly, I really like Apple and like Steve Jobs. And so the fanboys loved it as if it was really Steve Jobs writing it. Then the real fun was exploring all the stuff you could do online that you could never do in print. The involvement of the audience, the playing around with comments, and the fact that you could build this worldwide brand. I mean, my audience was all over the world. It was like having written about the internet for 10 years, putting your hand on the third rail and feeling it and going, oh my God. And then it was, you know, just light dawn, and I was addicted. I could not stop. And you know, for 2 years, that's all I did. My health went to hell. I mean, I gained 20 pounds. All I did was blog, and I just couldn't stop. A couple times I tried to stop because I thought I'm going to get in trouble. And then a couple of people told me, if it's that powerful, you should do this. I guess it's like what a crack addict feels like. Like, you know, I may lose my house if I keep smoking crack, but, you know, I'm going to keep smoking crack. Like, I was like, I may lose my job if I do this, but you know what? I don't really like my job that much anyway.
You say it's like touching the third rail. What was it about it?
Oh, well, first of all, the speed and the immediacy and the connection with the audience. And it took a long time as an old print guy to let go of some of the things about letting people comment and say bad things and blah, blah, blah. But after a while, it was like, you know, commenting. The comments were like the best part of it. I had guys who did all my Photoshop work. I don't know who they are, but if I needed a Photoshop, I could email a guy saying, can you make me a picture of Larry Ellison as the devil? And he would do it. So that was the amazing thing to me. And like when Gates said to, at All Things D, Gates got up and said, I just want to say I'm not Fake Steve. And then, you know, Mossberg asked Jobs whether he read it, and Jobs sort of said, oh, I do. I think it's kind of funny. Like that, all that was very gratifying, right? It was just very fun. And it was interesting and fun to do what ended up being this hybrid where some of the items were actually pretty serious. I mean, they were written in a wise-ass tone, but they were trying to do a real analysis of DRM or something like that. And they were long, and they were very thoughtful. And in many ways, a lot of it was much better than what I was writing at Forbes. You know what I mean? And Forbes wouldn't ever let me turn loose like that. You know, he just couldn't. And as you can tell, like, I mean, it's been a year now since I shut it down, and I miss it. I miss it a lot. It was the most fun I've ever had.
So why did you shut it down?
Because he came out last June at, I think it was WWDC, and looked really sick and gone. And to be honest, before that, in April, May, I had started hearing rumors he was really sick. So I had been hearing, boy, Steve's not doing well. And I had been actually making some calls and trying to find out if that was true, only telling people, like, I'm not going to write about this. I just don't want to do my blog. You know, if someone real, anyway, so he came out and then looked bad, and I thought, yeah, I woke up and I just said, you know, I can't do this right now. I just can't, I don't know, I just didn't have it in me that day. And even though, you know, I think the blog mostly, I mean, it was a parody of Jobs and took the piss out of him a bit, but it was also, I mean, I'm a big admirer, and I think that came through in the blog. It just seemed a little like bad karma to go near that. Now he's saying maybe he'll come back in June. If he comes back, then I thought, well, okay, I'll take the summer off. Because I had made a deal to take the blog to Newsweek, and they really wanted it, and they wanted that traffic. You know, they wanted the page views. I was going to take the summer off and start at Newsweek in September. So I said, in September, if he comes back and he's roaring and he's healthy, you know, I'll relaunch. And so I actually went to an event in September when I started at Newsweek, kind of to cover it, but also just to see what does he look like. And he didn't look good to me. So I said, I don't know, guys, I don't think we can do this now. I still harbor this fantasy that, like, if he comes back at the end of June and he's looking great and he's, I don't know what treatment he's been having or what he's been, surgery or anything he's had, but maybe I could relaunch as, like, Bionic Steve, you know, like I went out and I spent this 6 months and I had the implants and the, you know.
Stronger, faster,
yeah, better. Exactly, yeah, exactly, which I think could be actually funny, like twisted by, with, well, like, now it would be Steve, but with superhero powers, you know, and it could be good, or it could be that it just jumped the shark. It's already done, and leave it alone. Let it be, and do something else. I don't know. I sort of think it was like a one-off. don't know.
That was Daniel Lyons speaking with Kevin Anderson. Daniel Lyons, of course, the fake Steve Jobs. So, Dan, did you follow his blog? Did you watch it?
No, I wasn't a big reader, actually. I was very much aware of it going on, and I was very much aware that when he finished, he managed to get a book deal out of it, which I was quite impressed.
Kerching.
Yeah, right. That's one reason to stop and admit who you are. But yeah, no, looking back at it, actually, it is quite funny stuff. I was really, yeah, I was quite impressed, actually.
Well, he was, I mean, as he was saying, as Daniel was saying, you know, he had the freedom and the ability to really, you know, approach some very serious issues, whether it was DRM, et cetera, from a satirical point of view. Do you think it worked, Charles? Do you think that it created a new approach? Do you think that something that may not have happened offline or in paper?
Well, yeah, being satirical like that isn't new. All that was different was that he was applying it to tech and... you know, I would read it from time to time, and I thought some of them were hits, some of them were misses. The fact that he couldn't do it in Forbes, I think, says more about Forbes, actually, than it says about tech journalism. Because you could imagine it being in, you know, a magazine like, I don't know, Wired, and finding an outlet there. It's simply, you know, a guy finding out, hey, you can blog, and you can satirize, and you can write at length. And there's actually this big niche of Apple guys, half of whom didn't get the joke and thought it was Steve Jobs, and in some way pretending not to be Steve Jobs.
No, actually, Charles, you've got a long history in print journalism. Dan, you've primarily been an online journalist.
Yeah, I think I've totaled about 3.5 weeks in print, about 3.5 years in online. So,
how do you Dan feel the two differ in terms of writing specifically about technology?
Well, I think in terms of technology, most of my writing, a lot of the writing I read, will be more on the blogging side of things. And I think a lot of that is, you know, this is probably across the board for blogging, that there's less investigative type action going on, much more, I've read this there, that's, you know, let's write about that from this source. And actually, I think online, sometimes, particularly with blogging, that you do miss out on that, really, you know, actually picking up a phone and calling someone or really nailing someone down, doing that fence jumping kind of stuff as well.
Strange thing I'd never understand is why, you know, what is it about sort of writing a blog that makes it impossible to send off an email or pick up a phone?
I think actually that traditional journalists and, say, bloggers probably come from a different background. I think bloggers probably got into it through writing. Maybe journalists got into it through trying to find the story.
Increasingly, we're seeing that the offline print publications are moving online. Whether it's because of advertising costs or whatever. And so it's not just blogging that we're talking about. We're talking about technology journalism in general. And Dan is the editor of a technology area. What do you see is the eventual outcome of this? Do you think that technology is ideally placed for the web, or do you think there's a place for it offline as well?
I think it is, absolutely. I mean, there's a place for it offline. But I think I find it always very strange when I read a lot of technology on a very, very old, unadaptable format. I mean, what was the last real change in the physical appearance of print journalism? And if you're talking about something as dynamic as technology, you know, you really need to interact with exactly what you're reading. You know, paper doesn't, you can't embed video and music and all sorts.
I think the weakness of the debate is that people talk about the journalism, whereas actually journalism is, you know, is an activity. It's not a business. Publishing is the thing that wraps up journalism and turns it into a business. And actually what everyone needs to be focused on is, what is the new business model? You know, what is the new effective form of publishing? You know, the journalism will carry on in some way or another.
Oh, show me the money is what you're saying, Charles. Show me the money with the pragmatism. Well, you can read all about it in print and, of course, online. If you want to get your hands dirty, the print section, the technology section, comes out every Thursday.
Clean. It doesn't come off in your hands at all.
You can read all about it on Thursdays in the paper, or you can read all about it at any time at guardian.co.uk/technology. So what's been happening on the blogs? Charles, what's happening over on the technology blog?
Well, there's been a fair amount of fun around the Apple announcements. You know, I did a prediction ahead of the iPhone release, just looking at how Moore's Law suggested precisely what it was going to have. But there was also a fair amount of discussion about Apple once again rejecting a would-be app for the App Store. This was one for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where it was rejected, apparently because it linked to one of those mashups from the fantastic scene in the film Downfall, where Hitler is going completely bonkers in his in his bunker. The mashup was to do with digital rights management, and Apple seems to have banned it on that basis. In the discussion, Chris Jones said, I think it's understandable that Apple might object to carrying an application that gives access to open criticism of its business model. Because, you know, Apple relies on DRM for a lot of things. To which Elliot CB responded, lot like Safari, or SMS, or email, or telephone calls.
I like bonkers in the bunker. That's my takeaway, I'm afraid, from today's podcast. And he'll be reading that.
So like insane in the membrane.
Insane in the bonkers in the bunker. Well, over on the games blog, our readers have been, quite rightly obsessed with the cult of E3, the Electronics Entertainment Expo that happened in Los Angeles. And in particular, they are devastated by the sequelitis of this the crop of games that was announced at this year's show. Steve Boxer gave a scathing commentary on the eternal gravy train of sequels that's caught the eyes of some of our readers. Now, Briggsy, a regular on the games blog, leads the attack. He says, or she says, the accountants are in charge and they have been for a long time now. Only safe releases are greenlit. Hardly anyone is taking risks. God, even Nintendo are in on the act now. Time was, and you can imagine the mists here, time was when the Big N wouldn't dream of releasing two games in a series with the same game engine. Halcyon days, folks. Now they're too busy spending all the money that they've made from Wii Fit to bother innovating.
But too busy on the Wii Fit, aren't they?
Exactly, they're all really fit with their balancing boards. But overwhelmingly, what I found very interesting was that the peanut gallery, as I like to call them, is complimentary about sequels and was actually quite complimentary about the shows, the games that were coming out of the show. Rob Clark, for example, says that unlike movies, games almost never perfect their implementation or fully explore their premise in the first installment. And that is true because the technology does take a little bit of time to get used to. Dan, what have you picked up?
Well, I was having a look around the internet, insanely jealous, trying to find out what the Palm Pre is like, because obviously everyone in America has got it before us. And amongst all the reviews and bits and pieces, I found this video on Gizmodo, because apparently it's all very nice when it's closed, the Palm Pre, but when it's open, it has these killer sharp edges. They've got to find something to pick at. So this was a video of someone with a Palm Pre with one of these edges cutting some cheese. Good review.
Effective? I know.
Nice. Well, yeah. I
it
mean,
depends on the age of the cheese. And it depends on, you know, the consistency, whether it's warm, whether it's cold.
Other smartphones are available. Yeah.
Do you know, it did look a little pale and warm. I thought it was Dairylea to begin with, the way he was cutting through it. But no, apparently it was pretty solid cheese. But, you know, so then you got this massive string of comments, of course, about some people seeing it as a joke, some people thought it was funny, and some people were sort of like, you know, some Apple fans were like, oh, this is, you know, this is for us, and some Palm Pre people were like, oh, I can't believe you're picking at the Palm Pre, and it was really funny just trying to pick out the people that didn't know quite where to place it. And there was one, and I wasn't really sure where this, which camp this guy was in, but it said, that's what I'm talking about. I haven't seen an iPhone app that can cut cheese. Look at the Palm Pre. You don't need any software applications to cut a slice of cheese. You just use the hardware. What an innovative product that is. Palm Pre, for the win.
I really like the delivery.
I'll come back for my prize when the judging's done.
Heck yeah. Well, we'll be taking votes from the listeners. Regular listener Simon Thurston thinks Last FM was a bit stingy to make Jemima hold her interview last week in a toilet. Well, Jemima can tell you all about that next week when she's back. And finally, we missed Bobby in his pajamas this week. And last week, although we were promised one, that no photo was uploaded to our Flickr group, after we explicitly requested it. But you can see pictures of us and Bobby in his pajamas in Times Gone, and pictures of Dan if you really want to see what we look like. For all the links you need to contact us, head to guardian.co.uk/techweekly. That's it for this week. Many thanks to Daniel Lyons, Bobby Johnson, Kevin Anderson, Dan Sung, Charles Arthur, I'll add your surname in there as well, and Scott Colley over there in the glass box. It's been a roller coaster ride, and after all this talk about apples, I'm hungry. I'm Alex Krotowski, and I'm off for a snack. See you next week.